From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton, sitting in for Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, child actor Daryl Hickman will talk about his acting work with such film greats as Henry Fonda and Mickey Rooney. Also, we'll talk with organizers about two of this summer's music festivals. But first, on its third try, the California legislature recently took a step in advancing the cause of a high-speed rail system in California. Here to talk about that and other issues regarding passenger train travel are George Chilson, president of the National Association of Railroad Passengers. He joins us by phone from San Diego. Jonathan Hutchison, who is director of government affairs for Amtrak's Western Region, on the phone from Oakland. And Judge Quentin Kopp, who is the board chairman of California High Speed Rail Authority, and he will be joining us momentarily by phone. Gentlemen, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to talk about high-speed rail, but since all three of you are speaking this weekend, what are you planning to speak about at the meeting on Saturday?
This is George Chilson in San Diego. Tomorrow, I'm going to talk about the transportation crisis that this country faces, a combination of gridlock, petroleum prices, and air pollution as it's currently evolved into global warming concerns, and the role that trains can play in helping resolve this crisis in terms of moving both people and goods in this country. That's my subject for tomorrow.
And this is Jonathan, and I will be unable to attend tomorrow's presentation, although I have presented this group previously, but I have prepared a summary that outlines Amtrak's revenue and ridership for year-to-date, fiscal year 2008, and talks about Amtrak's 2009 grant request from the federal government for capital and operations. And this provides an overall summary of the state of Amtrak nationwide.
Mm-hmm. And what state is Amtrak in?
Well, we are on track, no pun intended, to have our sixth consecutive year of record system revenue and ridership, which is fantastic. We are seeing interest and increased intercity service around the country. But the problem is we have yet to see a funding commitment on the part of the federal government. And that absence really hampers this mode's ability to grow nationwide.
Mm-hmm. And someone just announced recently the Capital Corridor, it was just announced, has had its greatest ridership ever.
Is that, yes.
And who, George Chilson, you're involved in that?
One of our directors, Gene Skoropowski, is managing director of the Capital Corridor's Joint Powers Authority, and he has been the entrepreneurial genius that has taken this corridor and made it what it is. Doubling service without increasing the operating support needed, and as of the end of February, it was the fastest growing corridor in California, and California's three corridors were all growing in double digit rates. The Capital Corridor carried 20% more people in February of this year than it did February of last year, and as gridlock grows and gas prices rise and environmental concerns increase, more and more people are turning to the train as a way to preserve their quality of life and mobility without driving their cars.
In fact, you sound like you're sitting in a train or nearby one right now.
That would be me, actually. Amtrak's offices in Oakland are adjacent to the Union Pacific Railroad.
Okay.
And actually, that would be me also, because my home sits out looking over the bay, and the Amtrak coaster tracks are just down the hill from me. So both Jonathan and I live close to the trains.
Now, I wanted to get a little perspective on, we have trains coming right down through downtown Sacramento all the time. And we've often, Sacramentans are used to sitting and waiting for a train to cross while we wait. But the Capital Corridor, which goes through Sacramento and goes to the Bay Area, has gone up to 16 round trips a day. And I tried to do the math on this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it looks like that's about 4,100 people a day if you're doing 32 trips back and forth, or 16 back and forth. Do you have any idea of how many cars that actually takes off the road and what kind of an impact that is in terms of how many people actually travel back and forth between Sacramento and San Francisco every day?
I have not done the math, but you can figure that most of the cars that are most of the trips being taken on the Capital Corridor probably would have been made by car because air really isn't a practical alternative, number one. Number two, however many cars you take off of a road is important because congestion occurs at the margin. In other words, you have free flow until you add two or three motorists, and then all of a sudden the level of congestion is something like a hockey puck. It's flat until you get to a certain point, and then it spikes. So taking people out of their cars really does two things. It helps reduce congestion, or at least keep congestion from increasing faster. But more importantly, it gives people a choice and a way to avoid congestion and the frustrations that are involved with driving and dodging 18-wheelers and dealing with road rage and things like that.
And dealing with roads that aren't in particularly good shape as well.
Exactly.
I'd like to add to George's comment that the ability of the state of California to make the investments and the tracks and the signals to support the 16 Capital Corridor round trips that currently exist also benefits the movement of freight trains. And if you figure every freight car is carrying the equivalent of about three truckloads worth, if you improve the condition of the overall rail system for both freight and passenger trains, then that not only eases the congestion management issues in terms of commuters, but it also eases the movement of goods.
Just as a matter of interest, I went back and pulled some data in the fiscal year 2000, which for Amtrak ended on September 30th. The three California corridors logged slightly over 3 million trips. That's the San Joaquins, the Capitals, and the Surfliners here in Southern California. In the last 12 months, ending February 29th of this year, there were more than 5.1 million trips, and that's an increase of 70%.
Wow.
That's pretty impressive.
And to what do you attribute that?
I think growing congestion, rising gas prices, increased service frequency, and higher quality service.
And do you feel, because there was an article recently in the San Francisco Chronicle that was talking about the Capital Corridor, and they were saying that from door to door, somebody who lived in Noe Valley and was trying to get to the Capital to work, it took them about 4 hours each direction to get to Sacramento and back to San Francisco, because you can't take the train, obviously, to San Francisco. You have to go to Emeryville and then get on a bus. When you say improvements in service, what are you talking about? Are you able to narrow that or lower that time a bit?
Well, you know, let's put it this way. That's a wonderful segue into the segment that I thought we were going to talk about, which is high-speed rail. And certainly, when you talk about improved service, what the Capital Corridors has been able to do is improve reliability and increase frequency. And when you run trains more often, there is less time for people to have to wait for a train when they get to the station. So that cuts trip times. The expansion of the system is something that the High Speed Rail Authority, if its plan is executed, would do too, and that would greatly shorten trip times for people who are traveling to and from Sacramento and other major metropolitan areas.
But only that, right? It will only the high speed rail, and I do want to get into that. Is only going to be it's like it's competing more with an airline than it is with car travel, isn't it?
I wouldn't necessarily say so. It depends on right now, airplanes are the only way people can escape driving, and most trips are still on the highway. Now, sometimes it's going to be impossible because of the nature of a railroad, but the network of our road system. But for most people, I think it's going to make most trips possible, and I think it's going to take an awful lot of people off the highway. I'll give you an example. I was on a Surfliner train a little while back, and there was a woman sitting behind me, and she was on her cell phone. And she was saying, "Yes, I'm on the way to the meeting." "No, no, I'm on the train." "Yes, the train." "Oh, I wish I'd known this service was available years ago. I'm never going to drive to L.A. again."
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, you know, just a personal experience, but I think it's going to take an awful lot of people out of their cars.
Now, at the beginning of our discussion, one of you, and I can't remember, forgive me, I can't remember which one of what was talking about funding for the railroad and getting the funding up to where it should be, considering how much more ridership there is now.
That was Jonathan.
That was Jonathan. In that case, again with high-speed rail, we're talking about an enormous amount of money, at least $40 billion to make that happen. What kind of money are you talking about to get the current railway system, the current Amtrak passenger service, up to where it should be in order to serve the ridership that you have now?
Well, I think there are a couple ways to answer that question. For FY09, Amtrak has requested a base appropriation of almost $1.7 billion. Now, the issue, though, is what Amtrak has never had is sustained and adequate funding. So we make a request, and inevitably, we get less than that. So as a result, we have to defer capital investment. We can't buy additional rolling stock to make our trains longer, to upgrade amenities, to invest in track improvements, et cetera. So the Amtrak system itself has a capital backlog that's in the billions of dollars. Related to the three state-supported corridors in California, the Pacific Surfliner, the Capital Corridor, and the San Joaquins, the corridor agencies have determined that on an annual basis, they would need approximately $80 million in capital funding on a pretty consistent basis, adjusted for inflation, to continue making improvements that would do three things that George talked about. They would reduce travel time, increase reliability, and in some cases, add additional frequencies. And that kind of investment over time then allows a corridor, whether it be in California or someplace else, to realize the kind of gains that the Capital Corridor has enjoyed in the form of some reductions in travel time, but more importantly, increased reliability and increased frequencies. And in terms of high-speed rail as a tool, if you look at high-speed rail worldwide, for the most part, a high-speed rail system results after conventional inner-city train traffic has been invested to the point where all of the value, if you will, has been extracted from that system. Then once that is done, you move toward a new technology, which could be, you know, electrification or dedicated high-speed rail alignments, et cetera.
Okay. To summarize, what you're saying is that having the existing railroad system brought up to where it should be now would be a prerequisite for the high-speed rail for you?
Well, it's going to depend on the specific project, et cetera, but Amtrak's perspective is that fundamentally what needs to happen is that there has to be a federal commitment to this mode.
Okay.
And once that happens in the form of stable and adequate funding for Amtrak as the provider, as well as a robust federal capital matching program that is akin to what aviation, transit, and highways enjoys, then you're going to see a lot more investment on the state level and, of course, federally in intercity rail. And once that happens, you'll see increased frequencies, more trains going to more places, and that sets the stage over time for eventually investing in a new form of intercity rail transportation, which in this case would be high-speed rail.
And federal funding is definitely an issue that we need to talk about, because that will come up in high-speed rail. And I wanted to bring into the conversation Quentin Kopp, who is the board chairman of California High-Speed Rail Authority, and he joins us on the phone as well. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let me go to you then.
Sounds like I came in at the right time.
You did, absolutely. It was a good segue. What's your take on? First of all, I wanted to step back, and there was legislation that was recently passed that you had been involved in that was passed in the legislature. Could you explain to our listeners how that relates to the ballot measure that will be on the November ballot regarding the $10 billion bond measure?
Sure. The High Speed Rail Authority was established by statute in 1996. I carried the bill that set it up with a 9-member board, 5 appointed by the governor, 2 by the assembly speaker, 2 by the state senate. In 2002, the legislature voted to place on the 2004 ballot a $9.95 billion bond issue as the beginning financing for the high-speed rail project itself. That was then postponed to 2006, postponed a second time to 2008. It's on the November 4th ballot. Assembly Bill 3034, which was approved unanimously on a 10-0 vote by the Assembly Transportation Committee last Monday, contains cleanup language for the bond itself, deletes an obsolete provision which limited high speed to Los Angeles to San Francisco. The whole project, almost 800 miles, contemplates San Diego to Sacramento. The first phase, which we adopted, is Anaheim to the Bay Area through the Central Valley. And again, the amount of the bond issue is $9,950,000,000. And Assembly Bill 3034 also includes provisions requested by the governor to ensure there's no way to prevent private investment from a legal standpoint.
So this is good news from your point of view.
Oh, yeah, this is very cheery news, and we've got about, 12, 15 co-authors. There's a high-speed rail caucus in both houses of the legislature, which was organized by Assemblywoman Fiona Ma, and we are gearing up a campaign to pass that ballot measure in November.
Okay. I wanted to ask Jonathan.
Just a thought here. It was almost 18 years ago that the people of California voted to approve the bond measures that established the intercity rail program that exists today, that has resulted in the improvements on the Surfliner, the Capitol Corridor, and the San Joaquins. And that was 18 years ago. And had the people of California not had the wisdom to pass that bond issue then, I think how strapped we would be for choices in an age where gas is $4 a gallon and cheap flights are going to be probably a distant memory. I think the people of California are smart, and I think they know what's coming to us at the future and how important this is, and I really believe that they will get behind this bond measure and plant the seed for the system we're going to need in the future.
Now, one of the things that I've read in looking into this is that it depends where you stand on this depends on where you sit, where you live more specifically, because if you live in San Francisco or you live in L.A., perhaps San Diego, perhaps Sacramento, we don't know, you're looking forward to high-speed rail. But there are going to be a number of people in the state who may not benefit from this. It's going to be really a big city to big city kind of service, isn't it? And where does Sacramento fit into that plan?
Primarily, the second phase is obviously San Diego to Sacramento. Bond issue passes. We're ready to start construction after we finish the engineering, probably in 2009. Estimated construction period of that first phase from Anaheim to the Bay Area is somewhere between 8 and 10 years. The next phase is less than that, somewhere between 4 and 5 years. The cost of the first phase is $30 billion, with a third from state taxpayers, a third from the federal government, and a third from private investors. The cost of the second phase is about $10 to $12 billion additional, and the estimated time of construction, as I said, would be 4 to 5 years.
And what do you anticipate this is going to be politically for the state in terms of putting this whole thing together? There are different sides, and obviously we're going to be coming back to this issue before the November election, because there's a lot of money involved and there are a lot of different municipalities involved. What do you think it boils down to? And George, what do you think it boils down to in terms of railroad riders and how this is going to affect people, and how people should look at this in order to think about how to vote about it?
Well, I think the benefits, first of all, I think this is probably the most single most important transportation project, both in California and the nation. For the nation, because it's going to establish a precedent and for the first time bring truly high-speed rail service to the United States. That's going to have incredible favorable impacts for our economic development and competitiveness in a global economy where oil is going to become nothing but more and more and more expensive, and transportation efficiency is going to become increasingly important.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We're going to have to leave it there. It's a big subject, and we will be coming back to this before November. I can guarantee you that. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, acting teacher Daryl Hickman. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm David Watts Barton. Next week on Insight, former United Nations Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter tells you what it was like to work in Iraq during the 1990s. Also, author Stephen Hall and countertenor Ian Howell. Daryl Hickman was a child actor who appeared in a number of movies from the golden age of cinema, appearing with Henry Fonda in The Grapes of Wrath, Spencer Tracy in The Men of Boys Town, and with Mickey Rooney in The Human Comedy. He worked with directors John Ford, Vincent Minnelli, and George Cukor, and played football with his classmate at the MGM High School, Elizabeth Taylor. As an adult, he did musicals on Broadway, starred on TV, and has written and produced a number of films and TV scripts. These days, he teaches workshops in his acting technique he calls The Process, and has just published his first book, The Unconscious Actor. Daryl Hickman, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much, David.
With a resume like that, I hardly know where to start, but how about we start with the child acting days, because that's where the book starts as well. What was it like to be working as a child? You started when you were 7 years old?
Actually, 3 and a half.
3 and a half.
But the first time I had a real role, I sang and danced with Bing Crosby in a film called The Star Maker, and Bing thought I was cute, and he got me started. He sent me to his brother Everett, who was a big agent that we could never get into, and Everett's got my career going for me. So.
And you were 3 and a half years old, so you had somebody
behind
you.
Well, by the time I got to work with Bing, I was probably 6 or 7. I was an old-timer at that point.
And how did you get into acting in the first place?
Well, my mother...
What year was this for the...
Oh, now I'm going to date myself. Let's see. The Star Maker was probably about 1939, so a long time ago.
Okay.
My mother had always wanted to be a movie actress. She wanted to be a movie star. She was a Max Sennett bathing beauty, was too shy to get her picture taken, so it wasn't the right career for her. I came along and I showed some aptitude. She gave me singing lessons and dancing lessons, and I was good at it. So I became her career. That's how I got started so early, I think.
And then your first, in the book you mentioned it, working with Henry Fonda in The Grapes of Wrath was the first time you really felt like an actor.
That was the beginning of really seeing what I thought would be the right kind of acting for anyone to do. I watched Henry Fonda and Jane Darwell working with John Ford to shoot those wonderful scenes at the end of The Grapes of Wrath, and I knew I was watching magic. And I didn't know anything about the craft of acting, but I absorbed so much from people like Fonda and John Ford, and later Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. And those people really taught me what performing was all about, what acting was all about, what creativity is all about. And that's what I tried to put in my book, who I learned from, what I learned, and how I think that the same basic mechanics, what I call the mechanics of creativity, that are in all of us, are usable if we know how to use them properly to help us not only perform better in our careers as actors, whatever, but in life. And so that I've learned so much over my 70 plus years in the business that I wanted to share this information with as many people as possible, and that's why I'm promoting this book.
Okay. And you, when you're talking about acting with way back then and before you were barely speaking, I mean, you were certainly could barely read or write at that point.
By the time I got to MGM, I was at MGM for 7 years. After I did Men of Boys Town, they signed me to a contract, and I did probably 40 movies at MGM. I was the resident child character actor. Mm-hmm. And by the time I got there, I was probably 9 or 10 years old. And then for the next 4 or 5 years, I played a lot of different roles. I had learned so much from so many brilliant people that I was able to carry it off without any training.
And now you have it sort of formalized in the technique that you've developed. But when you were talking in the book about being an actor then, you said you were just sort of doing it naturally. You weren't really thinking about it. And how does that tie into knowing so much and then trying to teach it now as a technique?
Well, you're putting your finger on something very important. What I'm trying to get people to do is understand that what I did as a child spontaneously, intuitively, from my own unconscious, from my own inner self, from my own imagination, without getting in the way with my conscious mind, because I had no conscious mind activity. I didn't have the thought process that ruins so much adult creativity. Mm-hmm. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying to show people is how to use their innate creativity from their deeper selves and to add the conscious work that has to be done to create a structure for a performance or for a piece of art, and to allow that intuitive flow of energy to flow through that structure that one has to build. That's mm-hmm. the adult way to do it. As a kid, the structure was given to me by John Ford and George Cukor and Fred Zinnemann and so many great directors. But when you get older, you have to apply the same lessons that you learn when you're younger and put it all together into one process. And that's what I'm writing and teaching.
And bringing it back to a natural feel so that you can go through thinking all of those things and then come out the other side.
That's exactly right. The key to good creativity is doing the thinking when you need to do it and the structuring when you need to do it, letting go of that when you need to let go of that in performance, and allow your intuitive, spontaneous self to flow through that structure that you built. I call it flow through form, so that you combine your thinking mind with your intuitive unconscious self and you put the two things together in one process. That's what I teach.
And the subtitle of the book is Out of Control in Full Command.
Most of us live our lives trying to think our way through life, controlling our lives, rather than getting that control mechanism out of the way and allowing our deeper selves, where the real wisdom is, to take command of our creativity and to allow the creativity to evolve spontaneously.
This has a very religious and specifically Zen Buddhist kind of feel to it, but religious in or spiritual, I guess, would probably be a
better
word.
I was born and raised a Catholic. It has always meant a great deal to me. My mother was a devout Catholic, and I was a daily communicant for a long time. But to me, life is a spiritual journey, and I've studied all kinds of different spirituality, especially Zen, because as I write in the book, a Zen master, from Zen and the Art of Archery, the great classic book on how to train archers in the Zen mode, was really the inspiration for my teaching methodology in the beginning. So I believe that real creativity, real artistic achievement, is coming from the deeper part of ourselves or the spiritual part of ourselves. And if we work from that place, we can create something really wonderful and transcendent, especially in terms of art.
Now, so you talk about applying this for the average person in their daily lives or in their careers. But at the same time, talking about Zen, talking about acting, it sounds very high flown. How do you connect, say, if somebody is giving a presentation at an insurance salesman's conference or something at their kid's school, or I'm assuming that these are the kinds of situations.
Absolutely.
In which you want people
to use
this.
Practical thing in the world. The first thing you have to learn to do if you're going to be a Zen actor, as I call it, or an unconscious actor, is to be able to function in the present moment, to be here now, not to be projecting into the future or holding on to the past, to be totally aware in the present moment, as you and I are right now. If you and I could not have this conversation this spontaneously, if we were not both connected in the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't think and be connected in that state of awareness at the same time. You have to send out energy and receive energy spontaneously in the present moment. That's the basis of all good creativity. I see it.
And the present moment is all that there is.
You said it. The present moment is all there is. We project into the future, which is not yet. We hold on to the past, which is gone. So the present moment is reality. And unless we're living and creating and performing in the present reality, we're not in the present world.
So when you're doing that, somebody needs to be prepared. I mean, somebody needs to do their homework, right? So that then they can let go of all the preparation and just flow through the form.
Exactly.
As you say.
The art of performance is the art of preparation. If you know the rules, if you know how to use the built-in mechanics, and it's not that difficult to learn how to do this if somebody explains it to us. But if we learn how to use those mechanics properly and get out of the way, get our egos out of the way, get our thinking minds out of the way, get our need for results out of the way and let it evolve spontaneously and discover where you want to go as you do it moment to moment, you can create anything.
So what would three, trying to make it practical for people listening, and they certainly can buy your book as well, but what would the three steps be, or how do you break that down for people to accomplish that? Because what you're talking about are things that people spend their whole lives trying to accomplish, is being in the present moment. And
yes,
being
exactly. If they're smart enough to be able to do that. The first step is to learn to be in the moment and to trust your intuitive self and to allow that intuitive flow, which is usually images and emotion, to connect to your voice and your body and to flow freely through sound and movement. That's the first step. The second step is to go to the thinking self and to learn how to create a structure for whatever you want to do, to build the form that you want to build. The third step is to let go of the form on the conscious level and to allow the flow of energy that you're working with in the first step to flow through the form. Those are the three steps. Flow through form equals performance.
Well, that's beautiful. You are going to be talking about this at the bookseller in Grass Valley on Saturday at 3 p.m.
I am at 3 o'clock.
And is there anything else that you'd like to say about this?
I think you get a sense of how enthusiastic I am about all of this. I really believe in this so much, and I want to share it with as many of your listeners as I can. So please come at 3 o'clock and get a book and listen to me expound about this. If they can't come Saturday, they can always go to my website, darylhickman.net, and they can order the book through the website.
Well, Daryl Hickman, thanks for joining us. Our moment is over.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Next, we'll get a preview of two of the summer's biggest music festivals. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm David Watts Barton. You can download Insight from the web. Details are at capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from KXJZ News, unemployment is up in the Sacramento area. New figures out today show the jobless rate was 6.5% in March. That's the highest it's been in 10 years. That and the rest of the day's news later today on All Things Considered. Summer may mean baseball for some, but for many music fans, it means outdoor festivals. There's Coachella Festival in Palm Springs next week, the first of two annual Strawberry Music Festivals on Memorial Day weekend, and the new Outside Lands Festival in Golden Gate Park during 3 days in August. The festival scene just keeps growing and growing. Why is that? Our three guests will tell us more about the rebirth and triumph of the Summer Music Festival. Rebecca Sparks is a partner in the producing team at the High Sierra Music Festival, which takes place July 3rd through 6th in Quincy in Northern California. She joins us by phone from Berkeley. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Dan DeWayne founded and runs WorldFest, a four-day festival that runs this year from July 17th to 20th in Grass Valley, and he joins us by phone from Chico. Dan DeWayne, welcome.
Thanks, Dave.
And finally, Brian McKenna is Sacramento's premier homegrown concert promoter. His Abstract Entertainment does shows throughout the year around Sacramento. He is also an avid festival goer, and he is in our studio. Welcome.
Hi, Dave.
Hi. Brian, let's start with you. As a concert goer, because you go to a lot of concerts as well as promoting them, what draws you to outdoor music festivals?
Just the being able to go and enjoy it without the responsibilities that I normally have to have, you know, so I can go and have a good time and, you know, see acts. I'm kind of like a kid in a candy store out there.
But you also go to a lot of concerts, obviously. You promote concerts. What's the difference between going to a festival versus going to a concert?
Festivals tend to be a little bit more laid back. You got a little more time to kind of take it in, or you have more options for that matter. You can, if in festivals, there's multiple stages most times, and you can jump around to, from if you're not feeling what's going on one stage, you can go to another and see it. Whereas if you're going to just one concert indoors, you're kind of stuck there for the whole run.
And you're going to Coachella next. That's next weekend, right?
Yeah, next week.
Yeah, and how many times have you been to that?
I've actually been to that every year, but the first year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good one. It's kind of like going to a European festival without the big plane ticket and traveling.
And what makes it more like a European festival?
I think the way it's structured and the lineup, the way they do it. I know Rick and Paul, who started that festival, they actually went around to a lot of European festivals and kind of took it in, and from that kind of developed what became Coachella.
Mm-hmm. Dan DeWayne from Chico, you have a lot of history in concert or in festival promotion specifically. Why don't you just give us a quick CV on your background?
Well, I've had the good fortune of being involved with festivals since I got into this career 27 years ago. I was one of the co-founders of the Strawberry Music Festival and started the Chico World Music Festival and the California World Fest I'm doing now, as well as good fortune of helping a number of other folks get going in the business. And I was just reflecting upon that for a second there, thinking that one of the principals of the High Sierra Music Festival used to do the recycling program for us at Strawberry many, many years ago. That's Roy. And it's so fantastic to watch the growth of festivals from the time when I first began. I think there was only one really large festival in California. That was a bluegrass festival put on by the California Bluegrass Association. That was in 1981 when I first went to one of those, and that was the only festival I knew, and now there's a plethora of them everywhere, and they're growing every year, which is absolutely wonderful.
And California World Fest is held on the same site, is it not?
It's on the same site as the Bluegrass Festival. That's exactly right. We use the facility a little bit differently. Primarily because we have 8 stages, so it's quite a bit more and a little bit more eclectic of an offering. But it's that same beautiful location. The fairgrounds in Grass Valley calls itself California's most beautiful fairgrounds. And while some folks would argue, I would say, yeah, it's at least tied for first.
Okay, Rebecca Sparks, you may want to counter that. You're in a pretty beautiful spot up there at High Sierra as well.
Yeah, it's certainly as beautiful, I would say, and up in Quincy. We're kind of smack dab between Reno and Chico. Some people don't know where Quincy is, but it's a really little known treasure in Northern California that we've discovered and have made a great home for us.
And putting together the logistics of a festival must be something else. Dan mentioned 8 stages. How many stages do you have at High Sierra, Rebecca?
We have 5 daytime stages and 4 nighttime stages. So we have late nights when the music shuts down at 11:30 at night, we take our music indoors. So we have late night venues that happen until the wee hours of the morning for those night owls out there.
of which there are quite a few.
Yes.
which leads me to the difference between the festivals. There are a lot of different festivals. I mentioned in the intro that this Outside Lands Festival, which is starting, which is another Planet Entertainment in conjunction with the people who do Bonnaroo back in Tennessee, and that thing's going to be huge. It's 3 days with Radiohead, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Jack Johnson, and many other acts. It's more on the level of a Coachella. What World Fest and High Sierra do are much more modest, but the logistics and the number of bands still must keep you incredibly busy.
Well, all of these festivals I really believe that insane people get involved in event production, so we can all share that in common. It's both a lot of work and exhausting, but it's also very exhilarating. I think the key that I see to music festivals, or I think the most important part of it from my perspective, is this opportunity for the shared experience. Different than a concert setting, and I present 100 shows a year here up at California State University Chico in a in a concert setting, in a performing arts venue, which is a great thing. But the festival's a bit different, is that the crowd is invested in the festival a whole lot more. They are actually part of the participants that goes on to it, whether they're singing in one of the workshops or learning how to play an instrument or just that shared conversation that ends up happening. And what I really love personally about festivals is it's such a leveling environment. It really makes no difference what your job is, makes no difference where you live. It's simply, do you like this music or does your kid want to play with my kid? It's that kind of opportunity that we interact with each other that we don't get in our normal lives, which I actually think is the exception. The normal life, I believe, should be the festival world where we all get along and appreciate each other.
And one thing I can add about festivals mm-hmm. that have gone on for as long as ours have is that, you know, you really create a sense of community and a sense of family amongst the patrons that come. And, you know, it's their opportunity to spend 4 days together with friends and family that they haven't perhaps seen in a while or that live across country or whatnot, and to just relax and not have to worry about getting in their car for a whole 4 days. I mean, mm-hmm. that in our society is something to be said, you know, just in and of itself. And, you know, there's just a real sense of community and family. And, you know, festivals that have gone on as long as ours, you know, we have kids that have literally grown up in the festival, and now they're, you know, meeting people and starting to have their own families, perhaps. And it's just a really beautiful thing to see.
And what year are you in, Rebecca?
This is going on year 18 for us.
18. And Dan?
This is the 12th year of the California World Fest.
12th year. And you, there are a lot of things in common between the festivals that you have, music being one, obviously, good food and activities for kids. But there are there's a different feel to each one of these different festivals. Dan, how would you characterize World Fest as unique?
Well, I think one of the great things about festivals is the fact that they're very different, and you can go have a different experience. The same person can go to each of the festivals, and it feels a little bit differently to you. We have, I think the uniqueness about World Fest is, first of all, we have an extremely, a very eclectic lineup. It goes the whole gamut, and a lot of festivals are eclectic in some ways, and ours is eclectic in the sense that it covers virtually every kind of performance. I mean, we can go from Ozo Motley to Big Bad Voodoo Daddy to Emmeline Michelle, and you're going quite a spectrum in things there. But even more importantly, what I love about the type of festival that we do and High Sierra does and some of the others is that opportunity for discovery in there, that when folks come and they may be drawn to World Fest because Ozo is playing this year or they really want to see David Bromberg do his wonderful Americana bluegrass licks, but what they go away with is this discovering somebody brand new. And I think I was thinking last year, I know you were there, Dave, and the discovery of Moshe from Israel, mm-hmm. that was a hit of the festival, and virtually no one other than perhaps myself had ever heard of Moshe. And yet now we have all these fans that are requesting them specifically to come and play. So I think that's the thing that's really beautiful, is people go with a mindset that they're open to it, a little bit different than the Coachella and some of the others, where you go because you're driven there because of you know what this music is. The opposite is true for World Fest and to the High Sierra in some sense too there, that you're going to go away with something that you've never heard of before and get wowed by them just as much as the great lead performers that may have a little bit more of the so-called headline part of it, or at least that you have more knowledge of those folks.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, Brian and I were talking about this the other day when Prince is playing at Coachella and there are a number of big bands. Roger Waters is doing his sort of Pink Floyd tribute band. But you, Brian, had been saying that it's really the undercard that attracts you, and it's just that very sense of discovery, even at something that's as star-driven as Coachella.
That's definitely true. It's, you know, every year I go there, it's not necessarily the band that I, you know, the bands that I know already that blow me away. It's always something that I've never seen before. I mean, last year, the best act I thought I saw there was Kanono No. 1 from the Congo region in Africa, which is pretty far away from most of, a lot of the other stuff that was there, but they just completely surprised me, and I was really into it. And there's a band from Japan called Cornelius, which was actually really great too. So in that case, I mean, it wasn't any of the bands that I knew going into it that really walked away. I walked away from there, you know, really loving new bands that I'd never mm-hmm. heard or seen before,
like Moshe. And then Rebecca, when you're booking, you have a very set audience as well—not set audience, but you have regulars. who do you, when you're booking, you're sort of booking for names that people know, and feel free to mention any this year that you have, but then also names that maybe you want to introduce to your audience. How do you go about that process?
Yeah, well, it's always a challenge and a struggle for us because, you know, there's the comfort zone, like the comfort food of bands that people love. You know, for example, Michael Franti and Spearhead has been a staple at our festival for many, many years. Keller Williams, Railroad Earth, and a few of those will be appearing this year. Emmett Nershey Band, two members of one of Leftover Sam and one of String Cheese Incident getting together and forming their own band. So we kind of have to pull in a few of those acts that we have year in and year out, including The Slip. But then there's new bands that we like to introduce people to. And you know, Trombone Shorty in Orleans Avenue from New Orleans. We always try to kind of throw in a little New Orleans thing every year. And Groove Sex with Fred Wesley. And so there's definitely it's a juggle trying to, you know, keep everyone's favorites in the lineup because people do really want to see their favorites year in and year out, but trying to keep it fresh and keep it you know, real for people and trying to bring in some new music. We have Robin Ford this year with blues guitar players we've never had before. So we're real excited about the new acts that we have coming.
You mentioned New Orleans. Of course, the Jazz and Heritage Festival in New Orleans is in some ways sort of the granddaddy of all these things. Dan, you mentioned the Bluegrass Festival before, but going to a lot of these festivals, it does have that feeling of what you get when you go to the racetrack in New Orleans.
Yeah, a lot of the festivals that I've been really intrigued with over the years, when I was first beginning the Strawberry and looking at the Newport Folk Festival and New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, which are all run by the same company, or at least folks that are associated with that, and the Telluride Bluegrass Festival, or the Vancouver Folk Festival, all of those folks shared this thing of discovering different music, but they also had this shared thing of families getting together. I think that as you touched on it a bit, that you have a number of folks that continue to go to High Sierra year after year. The recidivism rate is really high. It's the same thing with World Fest or Strawberry or some of the others, that you have your own personal favorite that you want to go to. But that kind of thing that you're getting around like-minded folks, not necessarily that you agree on everything from, let's say, the political aspect or any of that, which is, you know, we'll set that aside. You're sharing this thing of, yeah, I want to be outdoors. I want to enjoy this new music. I want to discover something brand new. I want to eat great food, and I want to participate. And I think that's what a festival environment gets you to go and do that. And you never know where you end up, what you end up doing. I remember last year we had Daya Singh that came in from Australia, a wonderful Sikh spiritual singer. But his daughters, they were the support group for him, but they ended up doing a Bollywood dance performance that actually taught the whole audience. So, you know, having 500 people dancing Bollywood is something else. You don't get that in every circumstance, and you never think of that when you're going to a concert setting, but when you go to a festival, you're much more willing to get out there and shake yourself a little bit, that in a way that then you can take that away with you. You learn that new dance step, or you learn that new lick on the guitar, or you learn that new little tidbit by sitting there eating good food with some folks that you didn't know before. So I just really love that part of festivals.
And it's the festival part of the festival, really.
Exactly. Okay.
Rebecca, I didn't get to ask you about the overall tone of High Sierra and how that distinguishes, how that's different from any of the other festivals in the state.
Well, you know, I think one of our things that make us stand out is, again, like Dan said, the eclecticness of our lineup. But not only that, we offer lots of workshops, from everything from belly dancing to yoga to Pilates. And we also have educational workshops that people can learn about how to publicize your band, or you know, how to do a lot of the new electronic media we're going to have a workshop on this year. So there's a lot of offerings for everyone, you know, for someone who just wants to learn about the music business, to someone who wants to, you know, take Pilates. And those are things that really don't immediately come to mind necessarily when you think about some of these festivals. And there's a lot of opportunities there for learning stuff.
And one of the things that people don't think about with the festivals, but I've experienced myself, is that the bass player from Kinky may walk right past your campsite and say hi in the middle of, you're just sitting around having a beer or something. It's a very nice community feeling. We got to wrap it up there. Thank you all for joining us. Again, for information on High Sierra Music Festival, visit highsierramusic.com. For information on World Fest, California World Fest, go to worldfest.net. And Abstract Entertainment here in town is abstractpresents.com. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Dave.
Bye-bye.
A former United Nations weapons inspector is speaking in Davis. On the next Insight, Scott Ritter tells you what it was like to search for weapons in Iraq during the 1990s. Also, author Stephen Hall, his critically acclaimed novel, The Raw Shark Texts, is being released in paperback. Plus, countertenor Ian Howell. I'm senior producer Jen Picard. Join Jeffrey Callison for Insight. That's Monday at 2 on KXJZ.